It's 30 with Murdy with your host, Sweeney Murdy.
And welcome back, everybody, to another edition of 30 with Murdy. We're on a little book tour right now. Last time we were talking to Bob Clappish about his book Inside the Empire. And right now, I turn my attention to my friend Tyler Kepner. You've read him in the New York Times. And his new book is called K, A History of Baseball in 10 Pitches. It's available now from Doubleday Books, anywhere you get books. And first of all, Tyler, I want to ask you, listen, I told you this privately. I'll tell everybody else. I really enjoyed reading the book just from a fun perspective. You know, sometimes their books feel like homework. This did not. And I'll get more into that in a minute. But the idea of doing basically a century plus worth of baseball history the way you did it, how did that come?
Well, thank you, for one thing. And I've always been fascinated by that generation of pitchers that we grew up watching, basically. Guys who started in the 60s and ended in the 80s. I'm talking guys like Steve Carlton, Jim Palmer, Nolan Ryan, Phil Niekro, Don Sutton, all in all down the list. So I started thinking maybe I could do something just focused on them. But then as we sort of sculpted out the idea, I thought, well, why limit it to those guys? You know, if we're already looking at a big slice of baseball history anyway, why not just go for it all? You know, you see the patches this year. Is it 150 years? 150 is just manageable enough, I think, to where you can still reach back and find some interesting stuff, but not some stuff that's like so far from colonial days or pre-Revolutionary War days that people wouldn't be able to relate to it. So it was just manageable enough to get my arms around, and to organize it around the pitches I thought would be fun because you know, that's the game, right? I mean, right. These guys decide what to throw, and nothing happens until they decide what they're going to throw and where and why and all that. And so I just thought to be able to talk to the masters about what they threw, how they learned it and applied it, basically what they do best in their search for excellence, I thought I'd be able to, you know, get a lot of cool voices in there and people who would be happy to engage me on that.
Two things that struck me while I was reading it. You talk about cool voices. I read this book in your voice, and maybe it's just because we've known each other for so long, but I'm reading it, and I don't do that very often with books where I can hear the author's voice reading it to me. It's not an audiobook.
And you can literally hear it when I did the audiobook. Right.
Another plug. I like it. But the other reason that I loved reading is because I could tell, and you explained this at the end, how much you loved writing it. And so many times people talk about when they're happy that it's over, but the process is painstaking. You actually seem to like the process of doing it.
I did, yeah. I mean, I think it's a, you know, when you work for the New York Times, and I don't kid myself, when you work for the New York Times, like that itself may get people's attention and sell books. So I had agents who, you know, wanted to work with me over the years, and the agent I went up with was David Black, and he really understood that for me to do this and still keep my regular job and be a dad to four kids and a husband and all that, like the stuff that really mattered to me, I needed time. I needed a long time to do it, and it couldn't be rushed. And so to get 3 years to work on it was just perfect for my life and for me to enjoy this process and do it at my pace. Having that time allowed me to get certain guys who I missed in the first couple of years, but I got them in the third year of research. Roy Halladay was one of those. You know, those first couple of years in 15 and 16, he was, you know, not really involved in baseball. He was really hard to get. 17, he came back, and the Phillies remembered that I had asked about him over the years, and they let me, you know, they arranged for me to talk to him. So strategically, it worked out that way, but mainly, like you say, I just enjoyed the process because, A, I love history. I love baseball history. I love digging through the files in Cooperstown, and I just love talking baseball with guys, you know. And it's not you know, I wasn't trying to ask them things that made them uncomfortable or whatever. Like, just tell, you know,
their craft.
What you did great. Some of them were really appreciated being acknowledged and remembered. You know, like Greg Olson was like, wow, you know, you're writing about the history of the curveball. Thanks for including me. You know, like I won a Rookie of the Year, but didn't pitch, you know, wasn't a Hall of Famer, but like it was cool for him to be included.
One of the things that I appreciated was that as you read through the book, you realize that the pitches connect the pitchers from one generation to the next. I mean, everybody's got their Don Drysdale to Greg Brady moment, you know, and yes. That was a reference that you didn't make, which I was a little bit surprised by. But everybody seems to have that. This guy taught me how to grip this pitch, or I learned it by watching this guy, and it connects so many great pitchers from one generation to the next. That had to have been fun to just learn the lineage of everything.
Yeah, it really was, because I knew from, you know, just from covering the beat for 8 years with the Yankees and 12 years on beats overall, how pitchers like to talk shop and how they're always kind of playing around with that baseball and making it do interesting things. But the lineage stuff was a lot of fun. The thing I like to point to is Johnny Padres threw a changeup to win Game 7 of the World Series for the Brooklyn Dodgers. He becomes a coach. He teaches it to Frank Viola. And through painstaking effort, Frank Viola masters that pitch and uses it to win Game 7 of the World Series for the Minnesota Twins, who had never won before, just like Brooklyn had never won before. Noah Syndergaard becomes a pupil of Viola's in the minor leagues. It's not his number one pitch, but it's something he used in his arsenal, and he won a World Series game for the Mets in 2015. And along the way, you had Pedro Martinez learning it from Guy Conte, who was a Dodgers guy who learned it from Padres. Pedro helped the Red Sox break their streak, and kids across the Dominican and everywhere inspired by Pedro to throw changeups, like Kelvin Herrera, who threw it for the Royals when they won. So you can trace this stuff all the way back. It's a lot of fun.
Was the changeup your favorite pitch during this whole thing? Was there another pitch that maybe of the 10 that you described in really great detail, is there one that was your favorite to research and write about and talk about?
I don't know that I really had a favorite. Maybe the knuckleball. I mean, I've written a lot about that just because it's so interesting. Maybe it's just because those guys were so easy to get a hold of and just have such naturally interesting stories, because they're all kind of underdog stories.
Yeah.
And when you're telling stories, the underdog story is sort of always a winner. But they're all kind of underdog stories, because nobody really, except for, you know, Phil Negro, who threw it as a kid, planned to be a knuckleball pitcher. They just fell into it through a lot of effort and baseball rejecting them in other ways. So that was fun to be able to get, you know, the Wilbur Woods and Charlie Huffs and Candiotti and Steve Sparks and, I don't know, so many guys. So I might say the knuckleball. And also, honestly, to be able to practice knuckleballs with Jim Bouton in his backyard.
Yeah.
I went up there for a separate story, but I've talked to Jim over the years about the knuckleball, and we talked about it a little bit that day. But just playing catch, I wouldn't even plan that, really. It was just, you know, we had some time. I had my glove in my car, and, you know, we were talking knuckleball grips, and to be able to throw it with a major league, you know, former major league pitcher who threw it, and use a different grip than I ever tried before, with three fingers, that was a lot of fun. So that was like an interactive chapter for me.
Yeah, there you go. One of the things that I kind of learned and appreciated was that there are not a lot of new pitches in baseball. You know, it's people trying to tinker with the same basic group of pitches over the course of decades and decades. I mean, you know, the splitter has been around forever, and that's probably like the newest pitch. It's been around for half a century or more, really. Bill Mazeroski hit a cutter off of Ralph Terry, and I'm thinking that I never knew, and that's the pitch where you'd say, okay, it took maybe on more prominence because of Mariano Rivera, but it's not a new pitch. Guys have been trying to do things like that, just find different ways to make the ball move away from the batter for 150 years.
Right. They didn't always have names back then. You know, I don't know if when Ralph Terry let that ball go, he's thinking, here's my cutter, but he knows it's a fastball that moves that way. And now in 2016 at the Old Timers Day at Yankee Stadium, you know, that's how he described it. But I like talking to a coach named Ace Adams who talked to taught Cliff Lee in the minor leagues with the Expos system. And of course, Cliff Lee for a long time had a really good cutter with the Indians and the Phillies and Texas mostly. But this Ace Adams played it at Michigan. And at Michigan, he was coached by Red Fisher, who was throwing cutters in the 1919 World Series for the Cincinnati Reds. He actually lost. He's like, they were trying to lose, and I lost. They still beat me. But, he was telling Ace all about what that World Series was like, and so I got into a little of that because I couldn't resist. But just, again, the idea that, you know, even back a century ago in the Black Sox World Series, they were throwing a fastball to get in someone's kitchen. You know, as Chili Davis told me, he's like, you know, they didn't have names for him back then. You were just, you had guys who would get in your kitchen. You know, Jerry Royce would get in your kitchen. Woody Freiman would get in your kitchen. Certain guys would, Dave Dravecki would throw curveballs that would cut on you. They didn't call him that though.
I've got the Ace Adams connection that I'm aware of. I'll throw you a little bit of a trivia your way. He was actually the recruiting coordinator and pitching coach with Bill Freehan at Michigan when they were recruiting Derek Jeter. And Jeter ended up obviously being drafted by the Yankees, signing with them. But Ace told me a wonderful story about sitting down to lunch in Ann Arbor with the Jeter family and discussing the possibilities of them coming to Michigan. And the sixth pick overall in 1992 pretty much threw that all out the window.
He's not going to Michigan. He's going to Cooperstown, as scout Dick Rutch said in the Yankees, Yankees war room.
The fan, the in lore now. You made the slider chapter one. And, you know, you and I both grew up watching Steve Carlton and marveling at him. And kind of just turning us onto this world of baseball and what a pitcher can do. And you described that in your own version as well. Why was the slider chapter one?
I actually intended for the fastball to be chapter one.
The number one.
The old number one, yeah. You know. But my editor thought that it made more sense to make it the slider coming right out of the introduction where I talk about sort of me and how, you know, why I love pitching so much. And he said, look, it's your book. Steve Carlton was your favorite guy. You know, let's put the slider up front, and it just flows better that way. That was really all it was for the, you know, the flow of the chapters. But no, fastball, I did intend to be number one. I certainly was not going to make this book about myself. It's not about me. I had to sort of introduce myself a little bit to the reader, because I'm always very aware of what I'm not, and I'm not a coach, and I'm not a professional pitcher, and I'm also not like a history professor. So I didn't want to give people a sort of like they're reading homework, like a historical tome, like a textbook of just, you know, a chronological exploration of something. And I didn't want to make it a how-to book, because I'm not qualified to teach someone how to throw a pitch. And I didn't want to get it too bogged down in the weeds of numbers and spin axis and all this stuff. Like, I just want to tell stories. And we thought the slider stories worked best in that spot.
There was, in that chapter, there's actually a quote which jumped out at me as maybe something that every pitcher feels, every good pitcher feels when he's on the mound. J.R. Richards' quote to you was, "I felt like I was the baddest lion in the valley." And that just jumped out to me. Everybody who's ever thrown a pitch past a hitter must feel like that in some way, shape, or form.
Wasn't that great? Yeah. I've always been fascinated by J.R. Richard, just because he was – his career – ended before I really started following baseball, but I would still get his baseball cards because people kept putting him in the set, sort of hoping that he would make it back from the stroke in 1980, but he never did. Because you talk to enough people around baseball who faced him, and they hold him in such reverence, and I think part of it is because, like Sandy Koufax, he had a very brief prime, and nobody really ever saw him struggle at the end or fade out. You know, our last memory of Sandy Koufax is winning a Cy Young and pitching in the World Series, and our last memory of J.R. Richard is starting the All-Star game in July of 80. By the end of July of 80, he was done, sadly, with his strokes. And, you know, life was tough for him. I mean, he ended up living under a bridge for a little bit before getting his life back in order. But there's a certain sort of sadness and romance to a guy who had a brief career, and we never really saw the downside. It was just great until it was over.
As we go through the 10 pitches, something that sticks out to me is that there are a lot of guys who have a, what if I did it this way story to it? What if I just held it this way? What if I did something different? And it goes back to what we're talking about, of just being passed on from one generation of pitchers to the other. But I found kind of humorous the, one of the what if I did it this way, Randy Johnson actually demonstrated for you the key that unlocked everything for him.
Yeah, we're in a little conference room in Arizona at the Diamondback Stadium, and he gets up and he unfolds that 6'10" frame. And you know, Randy, when he gets talking about something, he gets really into it. Mm-hmm. Like, it was, you know, he was, as a player, even he'd be either sort of surly or he'd be awesome, and he would just talk forever. And so, like, this is one of the days he was very talkative. And yeah, he gets up and talks about how he was landing on the wrong place of the wrong part of his foot, and he needed to get more directional to home plate, and how Tom House saw him before. Tom House had gone to USC like Randy had, and Tom was the pitching coach for the Rangers. And he goes to Randy and says, hey, you want to go see Tex throw a bullpen, meaning Nolan Ryan? And Randy was like, of course. So they went down there, and then they sort of diagnosed what Randy was doing wrong with his foot. And it was, for him, it was really a two-part thing. It was cleaning up his mechanics finally so he could be more on a straight direction to the plate. And also, his father died that off season, and he said that gave him the chip on his shoulder and sort of the rage, the channeled rage that he needed. So, you know, he pitched with a fury after that, and he also knew how his body should work. And from that point on, he became obviously one of the most dominant pitchers we've ever seen.
K, A History of Baseball in 10 Pitches from Doubleday. One of the chapters is fastball. And the other 9 pitches in the book are all about ones that move different ways at different speeds. Velo is King is like the subheading and part of the chapter on the fastball. But the other 9 pitches are all about movement and deception. And the Bill Madlock quote that you use, I've heard before, says, how do you hit a curveball? Well, it's don't miss the fastball. Right. And I love as much as we focus on velocity, and the pitchers today all focus on velocity, they're all trying to throw every pitch as hard as they can. What gets them here and gets them successful are the ones that move different ways.
Right. And I use the Velo as King subhead because it was Trevor Bauer said that. And in the full quote, he talks about how getting through the minors, Velo as King, they're going to promote you if you throw harder. If you throw, you know, at a lower speed and get guys out, you're still not going to get promoted as much as the guy who maybe doesn't get guys out like you do, but throws harder. They think that's going to play better. He said, once you get up here in the big leagues, getting outs is all that matters. But to get noticed, you need to throw hard. And there's, you know, there's maybe a loss of nuance a little bit in that. And also sort of some people are concerned that if the bell curve is sort of shifting and that, you know, you the baseline for what you can throw is 95, let's say, that you're going to lose a lot of those sort of artists, like, you know, guys who, let's say, Kyle Hendricks types or Jamie Moyer, or, you know, a lot of guys. I remember Rick Reed covering him with the Mets, you know, guys who didn't throw, you know, much harder than 90, but could still succeed. I do think, though, that all this modern data technology will help those guys because you can see what a guy's spin rate is, and you might see a guy who throws 90 like Jay Happ or something, but he's able to get swings and misses up in the zone. And now, instead of just dismissing it at 90 miles an hour, that'll never play, scouts will be able to see, well, but look at that spin rate, that will play. So hopefully some of this technology, you know, could help some of those softer throwers.
Nearly every pitch that you write about includes a discussion on whether or not it leads to injury, the myth versus the reality of it. Most of the guys who throw these pitches seem to lead you to a conclusion that it's more about overuse than actually throwing a particular pitch and spinning your arm a certain way. But it's all part of the discussion that everybody has to go through, because you're talking about guys in your book whose career lasts only a couple of years versus guys whose career lasted 20 or more years.
Right, yeah. You know, unfortunately for the split finger fastball, a lot of the guys who threw it best in that era, late 80s, early 90s, didn't last very long. You know, Bruce Sutter and Mike Scott Gerelt, some of the other guys who Roger Craig taught it to, they had kind of short primes and then they were done. And they will tell you that, you know, Jack McDowell, another one, they'll tell you that it was something else that caused their injuries, not the splitter itself. But when a few prominent people, it's like I compare it to like a dog breed. Like when a few prominent people get bitten by this one breed of dog, and there's other breeds to choose from, a lot of people say, you know what, I'm not even going to risk it. I don't know if that dog is inherently dangerous, or if that dog, you know, brought along properly, it, you know, can be just fine. They're like, I don't even want to bother when I can do, you know, if you think the splitter is risky, then maybe just go to a changeup or something that's going to go a little bit slower and maybe not have that same exact action, but it'll go the opposite way from an opposite-handed hitter and maybe accomplish the same thing. That's especially what, you know, kind of helped drive the screwball away, because the screwball, people look at the inverted arm of Carl Hubbell and just the violence that you need not violence, but just the way you need to pronate. And they say, you know what, I don't even want to risk it. We'll just throw it, we'll teach the guy a changeup. But, you know, and talking to Bobby Valentine about the splitter, I thought it was interesting because he managed here in the 80s, and then he went to Japan in the 90s, and then he managed here again, the late 90s, early 2000s. And by the time he came back, the splitter was basically gone, but all the people in Japan were still throwing it. And when the Japanese pitchers come over here, so many of them have it. And Bobby's like, yeah, because they didn't have the examples over here that we had that caused us to panic and stop throwing it. They just kept throwing it.
The guys who throw a pitch and say, wow, that works, there's a long distance between them at that moment and what they can actually do with it and how they get through a career with it. You know, and what I learned by this, and I mean, I guess I kind of knew it just by covering baseball, but it stood out to me. The thought that stood out to me is the pitching isn't just throwing the pitch. It's throwing it over and over again to the point where you're trusting it, throwing it over and over some more, and even getting beaten with it, but still being able to throw it with a game, a season, or a championship on the line and trusting that this is the one that's going to bring it home.
Right. It's like, you know, when I talked to Dennis Eckersley about, we were just chatting one day and we talked about the splitter, and he didn't throw that pitch, but he said he tried so hard. He had a cast made for his fingers. You know, he spread his fingers as wide as they could, and he had a cast in the offseason. He would stick his two fingers in there to, you know, try to break down the muscles or whatever and give himself a wider split. And he would try at the bullpen, but he's like, you know what? I never really threw it because when I'm out there in the ninth inning, I've got to go to something that I can live with getting beat on, you know, that I can trust. And he's like, in those spots, particularly for a closer, like I can't go against my fastball and in his case a slider. So he never really did throw it, but that's how much he tried. It was like the thing with in spring training when Rivera would always talk about trying to change up, you know, and it was kind of a joke, but like he could try it, sure, and maybe even be able to have some success with it. But when you get in that moment, you know, every pitcher will always tell you, if you don't throw this pitch with 100% conviction, it's going to be a bad pitch. And it's tough to have conviction in a pitch you just don't throw that much.
We both quote Mike Mussina a lot, right? Just in everyday life. And I know that I could tell how much he influenced, even just not the parts he's quoted in, but how much he influenced the tone and the shape of your book. He has a description early in your book about all the variables to consider when throwing a pitch, and it's actually quite fascinating.
Yeah, he's, I mean, you knew him 1 year before I did because I started in 02 and you started in 01.
But nobody liked him that year, so it was fine.
Right. But like I kind of had an inkling that he would be good if he just stuck with him. And like Buster Olney had covered him, who preceded me as the Yankees beat writer. He had covered him in Baltimore. And John Lowe, who I knew very well, he was with the Detroit Free Press, knew him as a visiting writer. And these guys were just telling me, Mussina is great. Just hang with him, you know, get to know him, and he'll be great. And I learned more from him about pitching than anybody else that I ever covered. And, yeah, to have a two-hour lunch with him up in Montoursville, PA, where he's as happy as can be, that was a lot of fun. And you're right, he talked about just so many factors that go into deciding which pitch to throw. He wasn't the kind of guy who just trusted the catcher because the catcher didn't know how every pitch felt for him that day. For him, it was just about a feel. If I don't have this, I can go to that. If I don't have that, I can go to that. He had so many different plans to choose from. You know, it was always just, how do I get through this game? And he had a lot of different ways to do it.
One pitch he never got to throw, which I know kind of fascinates you in the history of it, the last pitch of the World Series.
Yes.
We've talked about it a lot. And it's evident, it's not explicitly said, but because I know you, how many times you refer to the last pitch of a World Series jumps out during the course of this book. No Mitch Williams. Is that too soon?
Too soon, right. Right. No, I didn't get into that pitch. You know, the slider, I think Joe Carter thought it was a slider, and Mitch thought it was a fast. Mitch was trying to throw a fastball or something.
It didn't move like a fastball. Like,
right. So I didn't get into that. I could have, but yeah, it's my choice. So but you're right. It was a good observation. Good job by you, Sweet.
Hey,
To see how many times I do refer to the last pitch of the World Series or any game in particular, you know, of a big playoff game or a perfect game or something. I just feel like that's the final moment that baseball has that the other sports do not, because the other sports you have to run, you know, the clock expires. Mm-hmm. Baseball, you have to earn that last out. You have to finish it. Very rarely does another sport, basketball, football, hockey, end with an action play. It's usually just dribbling out of clock. Baseball always ends in an action play. It's 11-0 in Game 7 in 1985, but Brett Saberhagen's still got to get the last out. Andy Van Slyke flies to right, and so we always have that moment. What I'm so afraid of is having a replay review on the final play of the World Series. Like, oh, we saw it last year with the Yankees Red Sox series, because you just want that last out and everybody jumping around and this finality to it and this amazing
like
highlight.
Like we do in the backyard, right?
That's what we do. Like, you know, every kid who was a Phillies fan of that, of our generation, knew how to imitate Tug McGraw jumping off the mound after striking Willie Wilson. Mm-hmm. And I think this more recent generation, same thing with Brad Lidge. So, you know, going to his knees and you know, yelling up to the heavens and having Chooch come over and Ryan Howard tackle him. So, yeah, I love that moment, as you know, and I tried to sneak in as many of those last out references as I could.
Your last chapter is the cutter, and I think it's actually quite interesting because it covers two main people in particular. One that you kind of adored the way you adored Steve Carlton, but got to do it as an adult in Roy Halladay, and Mariano Rivera, who you covered for so many years up close. Listen, it's such a great tragedy that Roy Halladay isn't here anymore, particularly when he is going to be inducted into the Hall of Fame this year, and that tragedy is going to stick out to all of us. But your ability to speak with him about his craft and about his pitch, what was that like?
Yeah, I mean, in hindsight, you know, in hindsight, I'm very, very lucky to have had that time with him, and that I can bring his voice, you know, to life here for the readers, because he had a lot of really smart ideas about pitching. You could tell that when he played, because he was just so serious all the time. But when he did sit down for an interview or even in a post game setting, he was very cerebral and reflective and interesting to talk with. So, you know, just being able to ask him anything I wanted that afternoon, it meant a lot to me then, because, as you know, like you said, I adored him, and I adored watching him pitch, because, you know, nobody made those great Yankee lineups look as feeble swings as he did. It seemed like they could never figure out until it was too late which way that pitch was going to move. It would go out on the end of their bats or in on their handle, and it was weak contact or swings and misses or, you know, pop-ups and broken bats and stuff. And nobody else did that to the Yankees. And then when he went to the Phillies for 2 years, he was, you know, at the best pitcher in baseball again. So, you know, just to hear him tell me about going up to Rivera at the All-Star game in the Bronx in 08 and saying, something's a little off with my cutter. How do you hold it? And then seeing that, you know, Rivera held it with a thumb underneath as opposed to the thumb on the side like Halladay did, that was just so cool. And how Halladay traced his fingers on the baseball and kept that ball in his locker for the rest of his career, and whenever he got off kilter with it, he'd go back to that Rivera baseball with a Rivera grip and get back online.
And Mariano Rivera, of course, had such great success, which everybody says he threw one pitch, which isn't exactly true. But I found Wade Davis's observation really unique, because, like, he basically says Mariano wasn't throwing the same cutter that the rest of us throw. He was throwing a different pitch because of how hard he threw it and how late it broke, and it's just different basically than the cutter everybody else knows. It wasn't mastering one pitch, it was basically throwing a different pitch.
Yeah, that's what they would say about Bruce Sutter's splitter. Like, you know, he could throw the split finger fastball, but he just did it differently. The way it squirted out of his hands, the action that it took on the way to the plate. Rivera's was a one of a kind kind of cutter there, for all those reasons that Wade Davis said. Rivera was interesting because he had a career that was, a lot of guys throw the cutter, but nobody threw it like Rivera. A lot of guys have, a similar save percentage as Rivera, but what made him so great was the longevity and how he took it to another plateau in the postseason,
right,
which was just, most guys over time, their postseason stats will be just about exactly what their regular season stats are. Even the guys we think of who were always clutch and who always came through, Andy Pettit, Derek Jeter, Bernie, all those guys, you look at their stats, they're pretty much the same.
Yeah.
Mickey Mantle even, but like, Mariano was a 0.99 or 0.90 something ERA in the world's in the postseason. He was just different. Bumgarner has been different. Gibson, Schilling, it's a very small, maybe even El Duque, like a very small group who performed much better in the postseason than they did in the regular season. And that was Rivera. And you talk about the cutter. I made sure to get the story in here because I remember reporting it in 2001 in conjunction with Buster, who was doing the Yankees then. I was doing the Mets, about the last out of Game 4 of the Subway Series, where Matt Franco, who had gotten a big hit off Rivera the year before, was sent up to pinch hit and with two outs in the ninth, and he stood way off the plate. He's a left-handed hitter. And Posada looked at Rivera, and they didn't even have to really say anything. They just sort of like, you see this? Like, you see what he's doing here? And so Posada just set up on the outside corner, and Rivera beat Franco with four-seam fastball. And Franco took it for strike three, and the only at-bat he ever had. And I asked him the next spring why, and he's like, because I can't hit that pitch. I'm giving up that pitch to try to get to the cutter if he throws me the cutter. My best hope to get to that pitch way out there is for the umpire to call it a ball, because I'm not going to do anything with it, because I'm protecting against the cutter. And Rivera was smart enough to execute.
The book is called K, A History of Baseball in 10 Pitches from Doubleday by Tyler Kepner. It took 3 years to put this one together. A Ken Burns-like pace. So what's next on your docket? Do you have something else, some other passion project that you're looking to write besides where we read you every day in the New York Times?
Yeah, I am definitely hoping to do another book with Doubleday. We don't have anything signed or whatever yet, but I do have another. I'm looking forward to going up to the Hall of Fame Library again this summer. I got a talk up there on July 17th, and that's right before the induction weekend. So I'll spend a day or so up there that week in the library and just digging in. But it will be another topic within baseball history that I can have a few years to sink my teeth into, and something that is very personal to me as well. So I guess I can't really say it until you sign a contract.
Okay.
I don't know, but but I'm definitely thinking of something else along these lines.
Can't wait. Listen, I told you this again. I told you this at the top. I told you this privately. I tell everybody else. This is just a fun baseball book to read. It's a history book that just, you want to keep going. The idea, Roy Halladay mentioned in, I can't remember if it was his perfect game or if it was the no-hitter that he threw in the playoffs, the idea that you build your craft to this and it's going along as well as it's ever going to go, and then all of a sudden it's just over. Like, you want it to keep going. And that's kind of what I felt reading this book. Like, I wanted it to keep going, and that's probably the highest compliment I can give you. Thank you for writing it. Thank you for talking to me about it.
Well, thanks a lot for saying all that. That means a lot. And I use that quote in the last photo we have there in the book is of Halladay, before the last pitch of the no-hitter, and I used that quote as the cut line for that picture, because I thought it was kind of some sort of poignance to it, because of how it all ended for him. But just that idea that, you get to something, end of something great, and you just want it to keep going.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, again, it was really, it ended up being a real privilege to talk to him and get him, his voice in there, but everybody. I mean, everybody's voice in there. I have so much respect, admiration for these pitchers and what they do. And just to tell their story and to maybe know that you you know, you told it right is very gratifying. So thanks.
And I'll tell you, my other favorite line was when you tell the Sparky Lyle story and weave it into Paul McCartney. It was such an easy game to play.
Yes.
I like it.
Had to get some of that in there, of course.
K, A History of Baseball in 10 Pitches by Tyler Kepner at Doubleday, anywhere books are sold. You can follow Tyler reading the New York Times and at Tyler Kepner on Twitter. Thank you, everybody, for listening. More 30 with Murdy coming up down the road. Appreciate you tuning in and listening this time.